Welcome to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us by the tree. One of the primary fixations of many Mahayana sutras is how they will spread and who will spread them. From the 1st to the 6th century CE, a title for the ideal teacher begins to repeat itself, the Dharmabhanaka, or Dharma preacher. Eloquent and creative, skilled as a performer and an exegete, authorized by Buddhas and protected by gods, the Dharmabhanaka appears almost mythical. So much so that scholars who study Dharmabhanakas wonder whether these are even real historical figures. But that question itself might be holding us back.
So I say, well, what if we stop asking a purely historical question and we start to think more thematically and we try to take seriously what Mahayana sutras say about those idealized figures who would convey them, right? Dharmabhanakas. But then I needed language for that. I needed a way to think through these figures. I needed traditions that have a sustained history of studying figures of religious authority, of studying preachers, have language for studying sermons, homilies, right, etc. And that is why I started to look further afield.
Further afield might mean comparing the Buddhist Dharmabhanaka with the evangelical Christian preacher. But it also might mean leaving the temple or the church altogether and joining the congregation of a different arena. If the ideal Dharma preachers are those dynamic, commanding performers who propagate Buddhism to the biggest crowds, then one of the star Dharmabhanakas of our time, or as you might put it, simply the best, was Tina Turner, the queen of rock and roll.
Tina Turner spoke about and considered her life's mission, from her own words, right? She considered herself to be a Dharmabhanaka. You know, she didn't use the language, but she considered herself to be somebody who was using her life and career to spread Buddhism.
I'm your host, Miles Osgood. My guest today is Ralph H. Craig III, Assistant Professor of Religion at Whitman College in Washington State. Ralph started his academic studies at the New School in New York, majoring in Global Studies at the Eugene Lang College of Liberal Arts, before completing his BA at Loyola Marymount University in Theological Studies. He came to Stanford to do his doctoral work in religious studies with an interdisciplinary focus on South Asian Buddhism and American Buddhism. In 2023, he defended his dissertation, Preachers of the Great Way, the Dharmabhanaka in Mahayana Buddhist Sutras. This will be the subject of his forthcoming monograph. Ralph is a rarity among scholars in that he also completed a first book during his PhD, a spiritual biography on the Buddhist conversion and teachings of Tina Turner, titled Dancing in My Dreams, published by Erdmans in 2023. So we'll be talking about both that book and the thesis in the conversation to come. On these topics and others, Ralph has published articles in Buddhist Christian Studies, American Religion, and the Japanese Journal of Religious Studies, with public essays in Lion's Roar and Tricycle magazines. Prior to his current position at Whitman, he was lecturer at Dartmouth College, and next year he'll be a Numata visiting scholar at Princeton, where he is also a member of the Crossroads Project on Black Religious Histories, Communities, and Cultures. For now, we're glad to have him back at Stanford and at the Ho Center, so let's head into the library.
Welcome back, and thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be back. And I want to thank you right off the bat for your thorough preparation. I'm very excited.
Oh, good. Well, no, that's very nice of you. Thanks. Well, all right, so let's get into it a little bit. The Dharmabhanaka theme makes me want to ask, as you introduce yourself to our audience, about preachers and teachers, maybe, in your own background that might have meant something to you on your path to religious studies, turning you on to this field, getting you prepared to be a speaker and teacher in your own right. Who stands out as models of instructors in your past?
That is a very good question. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, you know, I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. And New Orleans has a strong funerary culture. You know, we have these big second lines of jazz funerals, and funerals are big to do. And so some of the first people that I was conscious of thinking about as teachers of a kind, as authority figures, as great orators, were actually not preachers, but funeral directors. And there were a number of women who were funeral directors, and there were a number of men, and I would, you know, they were just so dignified, and they would, you know, they're kind of small roles at a funeral in a church, you know, they were kind of master of ceremony kind of thing. Yeah. And I was always impressed by that, and I wanted to be a mortician. That was my childhood dream. I wanted to go into that. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was both poignant. I wouldn't have said that as a child, sure. But... you know, as I got older, I thought it was so poignant, but also a very dignified thing. Aside from that, I knew this pastor, Reverend Murphy, had a big impact on me. You know, he was very kind of slow preacher. You know, he was kind of methodical, and I was very into that kind of thing. But then there was the home, right? So there were all these people at home, my mom and. Some of them were educators. My nanny, Miss Blanton, she was an educator. And so these were people who, you know, they would sit and they would read the Bible with you, redo math problems with you, do all of these things. Yeah. So to me, I always saw religious authority, preaching, teaching as a part of the same kind of authoritative position holding.
Yeah.
And that had a tremendous influence on me.
Yeah, it sounds like you're meeting folks who are doing exegetical work, pedagogical work, ritual work of various kinds.
Yes.
So you mentioned Reverend Murphy and the funerary rites. What kinds of denominations were you witnessing, or what kinds of traditions were you witnessing? And were you already a comparativist at that moment, saying, here's how this church does it, here's how this denomination does it?
I like that way of putting it, a comparativist from the... Yes, because most people in New Orleans are, many people in New Orleans are Black Catholics. Mm-hmm. But there is a strong, obviously, Baptist contingent. And in my own family, the majority of my family is Catholic, but there's a strong missionary Baptist contingent to the family. And there are a few Black Pentecostals in my family as well. So I went to all of them. You know, whoever's house you were by, that's what church you went to. Yeah. So if you're by your cousins and they were going to Mass, that's where you would go. Or if they were over by us and we were going to Sunday school, that's where we were going. And of course I was noting the differences. As a child, I wasn't so much thinking formally comparatively, but I was thinking about the very real differences in the affect, right, and the actual behavior of congregations, right? What was acceptable? What is the ritual? What does the liturgy mean in this context? What's expected of me as us or my family as a congregant in one kind of space versus another, right? In a Catholic setting where you're supposed to stand up, right? There's a set ritual and there is a bodily practice at play where you stand at this time and you sit at this time and you do this and that. Whereas in a Baptist church, you're expected to respond. You know, they call it like a talk back audience or call and response audience. So if you sit in a Baptist church the way you do in a Catholic church, it's just kind of quietly take it in. The preacher feels that they're doing something's not right.
Yeah.
So all of this I was paying attention to throughout much of my life.
Yeah, great. So not just the practices of whoever is at the pulpit, but the practices in the pews.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So tell us a little bit about how then your interest was piqued by Buddhism, and maybe the Soka Gakkai International in particular. How did that come into your view?
Yeah, I had read the Hermann Hesse novel Siddhartha. And that is that's an interesting text because it's not about Buddhism, right? It just uses the Buddha's life as a frame story. But I was very moved by it when I first read it. And the main character said, you know, Siddhartha, said, I can think, fast, and wait. And I was obsessed with that. I would run that line through my mind like a mantra. You know, anything I wanted, anything I thought about, it's like, if I can think, fast, and wait, I can do it. Right? And so I went and told my mother, I want to learn more about Buddhism. I want to study Buddhism. And my mother was like, okay, why not?
Yeah.
Right? That was the beginning for me. And when I started to research different Buddhist communities in New Orleans, you know, Soka Gakkai was one of the most prominent. You know, it's pretty small, you know, It's not hard to visit all the Buddhist communities in New Orleans. And Soka Gakkai was one of them. So that's how I first started to go and learn what they were about. And then I discovered, you know, that they have this tradition of African-American artists, practitioners, you know, kind of major figures, Tina Turner, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, people like that. But then I also started to learn about this greater story beyond Soka Gakkai of Japanese Buddhist traditions in America. Right? Some of the first Buddhist in America. Some of the first are Japanese Buddhists. Right? Yeah. And the establishment of these communities, both in Hawaii and then in San Francisco, etc. So I started to learn this kind of greater history. Right? And then came to find out how these kinds of communities, these Japanese Buddhist communities, are often written out of the history of Western Buddhism, right? American Buddhist traditions, et cetera, et cetera. Right? They're often written out of these histories, and there are particular reasons for that. So all of this started to come together for me in my research.
Yeah, okay, fascinating. So this makes me want to ask a little bit about the kind of continued presence of a kind of Christian theological understanding and background and Buddhist in your studies. Because as you were coming into graduate school, I understand, like, you had this publication that you were working on that ended up appearing in the Christian Buddhist Studies journal, where you're thinking about Nichiren and the Gongyo and Christian liturgy together. Mm-hmm. Then you keep going in your dissertation work, and you've got, you're using the medieval Catholic artist Praedicandi as a way of thinking about what the Lotus Sutra is then saying about the Dharmabhanaka.
Yeah.
And then you keep going, and you say that, you know, there's something about specifically the Afro-Protestant church and the exhortation to kind of make it plain that explains the exegetical work that's also being done by these Buddhist preachers, you know, back at the turn of the first millennium. And you know, I'm mindful of all of that, but also of the fact that early in your dissertation, you acknowledge that there's a potential worry there of a history, an Orientalist history of kind of imposing a kind of understandable Western framework for Western audiences on an understanding of Buddhism that could persist even in sort of neo-colonial projections.
Yeah.
So you're clearly thinking about that. You're open to worrying about it. And yet it has such a productive role, it seems, in your published research, in your dissertation. So tell me a little bit about how you thread that needle or think about the utility of that comparative glance.
Yes. So with the Nichiren work, and the work of Karl Rahner, which I was looking at in that first publication, I became struck by the idea that liturgy teaches you, right, how to be, right? That the liturgy tells you what to think, what to do, right? How to form yourself. So liturgy and self-formation go together, right? Liturgy and self-cultivation can go together. And so as I started to think through Rahner, I started to think about his theology of symbol, right? And I started to think of Nichiren along the same lines of, like, how does the practice of Gongyo, as understood in the Soka Gakkai Nichiren Buddhist community, how does that practice tell, is there a similar work of symbolism there? Does the liturgy function in the same way?
Could you talk us through that a little bit? Like, what are some of the symbols in both contexts and how do
right. you work? So what, for example, Nichiren's inscribing of the calligraphic mandala that is often called the Gohonzon or the Honzon, right? Where Honzon means like object of devotion. So in many Nichiren Buddhist traditions, not all, but in many lineages of Nichiren Buddhism, the Gohonzon is a calligraphic scroll, right? So it's not necessarily a statue or something like that, or even a painted image, like a tanka in Tibetan traditions, for example. It's not that, it's an inscribed, there's calligraphy with the Daimoku, the title of the Lotus Sutra, down the center, and then other characters representing either Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and this kind of thing. And so that, for Nichiren, is the embodiment of awakening. It both depicts a scene from the Lotus Sutra, the ceremony in the air in the Lotus Sutra, where this kind of, you know, cosmic moment where Shakyamuni and then Many Treasures Buddha, you know, Prabhupada, comes up and his stupa comes up and the congregation gets lifted up, right? and all of this, and Nichiren he inscribes the Gohonzon as a graphic representation of that, right? As that is the awakened state.
Yeah.
So this as a symbol then of the awakened state, how does it function for Nichiren? That was like my driving question. Mm-hmm. And how out of this does Nichiren construct an anthropology, right? Mm-hmm. How does Nichiren understand the human being in a liturgical context? Mm-hmm. That's what I was getting at there. But that work in Buddhist studies, I found the way that many have thought about, for example, sadhanas in like Tibetan tantric traditions, right, practices around studies of ritual texts and ritual manuals. No one was really asking the question that I was most interested in, right? Their work was touching on it, and I was drawing on the work of these phenomenal scholars in Buddhist studies, yeah. But no one was really asking what I wanted to know, right, in the way that I wanted to know it.
Sorry, so what was that? Was that the relation between symbol and self?
Or? Right, between symbol, liturgy, and self-cultivation, mm-hmm. and how a particular Buddhist tradition, in this case, Soka Gakkai's understanding of Nichiren Daishonin, how that tradition understands the person as being formed by the liturgy, mm. right? So the way a liturgy is constructed is it tells you what is worth worshiping, mm. what is worth saying, right? What is worth doing with your body. When the liturgy says, you know, I pay homage to Nichiren, the Buddha of the latter day of the law, the liturgy is telling you how Nichiren is being conceived of, how you should think of him, right, and what it should be your relationship to him, namely as a being who, as someone who pays homage to him, right? Liturgy does this work, right? But in so doing, it also tells you something about how that tradition understands the human being, right? Mm-hmm. That the human being has a relationship between themselves and the Buddha, for example, as mediated by the Lotus Sutra, in this case. So Nichiren says that every character, some 69,000 or so characters of the Lotus Sutra, Nichiren says that every character is a Buddha, hmm. right? So when you pay homage to the Sutra, you pay homage to every character, right? That's telling you something.
Yeah.
And these are the kinds of questions I wanted to ask.
Yeah, okay.
But you're absolutely right, and I have this methodological discussion in my dissertation that there is a risk of taking... First of all, we have to think about right, Christianity and Buddhism. Right? Mm-hmm. These are two different traditions.
Yep.
Then some of the material I'm drawing on from Christian studies is from the late antique period. Mm-hmm. Right. For Buddhist material, I'm talking about the pre-modern period, the kind of turn of the common era and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So is it appropriate to apply categories from one context to another? If we do it carefully, right, there can be something methodologically fruitful there, right? In Buddhist traditions, studies of religious authority, like of preaching, right, despite how many Mahayana sutras talk about the figures who would disseminate these texts and exhort others to become bodhisattvas who spread the teachings, there are very few studies, right, based on Mahayana sutras about figures like Dhammapada. Now, for some scholars, I think that the issue becomes, it is not clear the extent to which Dharmabhanikas, what their historical social location was. Mm-hmm. Were these actual figures, right? We have travel logs from Chinese pilgrims that do seem to match, some of the preaching scenes they describe seem to match. But does that mean that these Dharmabhanikas were actual historical figures? That question has hung up, I think, many of scholars. But this is where I think we have to bring in the work of a scholar like Jan Natier, who says, right, one thing that we know, we may say that these texts are normative texts, and she has done phenomenal work to show the kind of normative claims that are being made in these texts and how those claims actually present a very different Mahayana than many people think, than like popular conception. Mm-hmm. At the same time, what Jan Natier points out is that one thing we know these Buddhists did was construct normative depictions, right? So whether, even if it's only a normative depiction and was never maybe actually done.
Like an ideal individual.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
these texts created those ideas. Real people created those ideas.
Yeah.
So what the work that I was doing in the dissertation was to leave the historical question aside. Mm-hmm. I think there have been many dissertations.
Yeah.
Well, not that many, actually. But a few key dissertations that have kind of looked at this history, kind of yeah. thought through this history. So I say, well, what if we stop asking a purely historical question and we start to think more thematically and we try to take seriously what Mahayana sutras say about those idealized figures who would convey them, right? Dhammapada. But then I needed language for that. I needed a way to think through these figures. I needed traditions that have a sustained history of studying figures of religious authority, of studying preachers, have language for studying sermons, homilies, right, etc. And that is why I started to look further afield.
Yeah.
And I was inspired in this work by a scholar named Stephen Tizer, Buzzy Tizer, who's at Princeton, who had an article come out in AR's Religious Citizen Journal of the American Academy of Religion mm-hmm. on prayer. Right, and why, you know, is prayer an appropriate term to use for Buddhist practices? And he makes an argument for why, even with the baggage of a term like prayer, it can be appropriate to use. He makes an argument for why that is. And I, in my dissertation, I sought to do something similar, right?
Yeah.
To make an argument for why we should understand Dharmabhanikas as preachers and think through them using categories and language
yeah.
drawn from traditions that have studied preachers.
Yeah, so in a moment we should just hear more from you about what the sutras internally tell us about those mm-hmm. preachers, you know, ideal or historical. But while we're on this question of sort of what other religions and their traditions of looking at this kind of category can do for us,
mm-hmm.
I am curious about the fact that you cite, I think, Natalie Gummer saying, like, yeah, perhaps these Dharmabhanikas are like evangelical Christian preacher.
Yeah.
Does that seem right to you, or yeah. would you refine that definition, or how do you think about that comparison?
I think that that's true. I think that the sutras, many Mahayana sutras, imagine their Dharmapanikas as these charismatic figures who spread the Dharma. Now, some of the arguments that I make are different from the kinds of arguments Natalie Gummer makes. She's interested in different sets of questions.
Sure.
But we share this concern with, right, Dharmabhanikas and taking sutras seriously when they talk about these figures. And I think that I think that she's right, that there are ways in which they can be fruitfully compared to evangelical preachers insofar as there is a concern with exhortation, a concern with evangelizing,
mm-hmm.
right? A concern with spreading. I mean, many Mahayana sutras, if they're concerned with anything, it's their own spreading, and then the figures who would do that spreading, right? What something I became fascinated with, and my advisor when I was at Stanford was Paul Harrison. Something I became interested in that, you know, Paul Harrison has written about, that Natalie Gummer has written about, and other scholars, this self-referential quality of Mahayana sutras mm-hmm. that then makes it so that when the sutras talk about these figures, when they talk about themselves being preached, and you read that,
yeah.
or even speak it aloud, or even read it, you are participating in, you are becoming a Dharmabhanika by definition.
Right? Mm.
You are by definition doing what the sutra has asked. And when the sutra says, you know, in 500 years, 1,000 years, or whatever, that this message will be disseminated. Here I am, I'm a professor in a college classroom disseminating these sutras. So I find that a very interesting thing, you know, when a sutra says in the 500 year period of the last days, you know, after the Buddha has passed away and this and that, the Dharma will be spread. It's like, yes, we're doing it.
So we're going to come back to that. So there's the analog of the preacher, but then the analog of the professor and of professing in that respect. Yeah, it does seem really interesting. So okay, so let's dig a little bit more into what you learned from within the sutras themselves about the Dharmabhanika and you know, and then what you could take on yourself. So what was important to you to add to the discussion that you were seeing out there about these figures? What were you noticing in the selection of sutras, Mahayana sutras, that you took on?
The first problem, right, is what does Bonica mean? Hmm. Right. This is heavily debated in the literature. It's clear grammatically what it means, right? It comes from a root that just means to speak, yeah. to recite, to say. So there's nothing strange about that, right? So Bonica, one who speaks, recites, or says. The question, though, is, were Dharma Bonicas, historically, were they figures who merely recited the Dharma, right? Literally recited the words of the sutra? Are they, as some scholars have asked, are they figures who created the sutras, right? Maybe through inspired revelation, maybe in some other way, but are they the actual authors of the sutras? Or were they actual exegetes, right? Did they actually preach about the sutras, right? In other words, not just recite the words of the sutra, but expound on those words. What I discover with the sutras themselves often imagine, right? So I'm thinking particularly, for example, of the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, right? So-called Lotus Sutra. This sutra envisions more of its Dharma Bonica than simply reciting the text. It speaks of the Dharma Bonica giving sweet sermons, and it speaks of what their disposition should be and how they should take their seat before the crowd, right? Many of these descriptions seem to imply that, at least from the standpoint of the authors of the sutra, anonymous though they may be, at least from their standpoint, this is a figure that is imagined not as simply reciting the Dharma, but preaching about it, right? Expounding on it. Right? Now, preaching or expounding upon the Dharma is but one of five or six practices in the standard list, right? Copying out the sutras, reciting the sutras, sometimes actually carrying the physical, bearing the sutra, memorizing the sutra, etc. So my argument is not that preaching is, in the dissertation anyway, the argument was not that preaching is like the sole activity described in these sutras. One of the fascinating things about Mahayana sutras is that they are almost these, and I say this in the dissertation, right, that they are, as a genre, they are almost these encyclopedic works that are like a greatest hits. Almost as if to say, if you only had the Lotus Sutra, you only had the Ashtasahasrika, the perfection of wisdom in eight lines, or something like that, if you only had that manuscript on you or memorized, you would have the entirety of the Buddha's Dharma. So there's material in Mahayana sutras that reads like Vinaya text. There's material, you know, like monastic literature.
Right.
There is material in Mahayana sutras that are basically Jataka tales. These are, you know, past life birth stories of the Buddha. There's material in Mahayana sutras that read like Avadanas. These are kind of narratives that are usually pull out some kind of karmic connection about the character that the Buddha is talking about. All of this in any given Mahayana sutra. Yeah. Right? So my claim is not that these sutras are only about preaching, but just as people have centered, right, I'm thinking of the work of somebody like Brian Lowe, who wrote the book Ritualized Writing, you know, just as people have centered how sutras exhort the copying of them, sutras also exhort the preaching of them, and we should take that seriously.
And it sounds like the preaching elements of these sutras must be of a kind of preeminent importance insofar as this is how that sutra is going to get out into the world, this is how to think about it, this is how to properly expound upon it, how to read it, and then become maybe a Dharma Bonica in turn.
Right.
Is that right? Yes.
Yeah.
So it's playing this sort of, you know, metatextual role of allowing the importance of this text to grow.
Right. And the Buddhist tradition, I mean, many texts, not just Mahayana sutras, it's about its own spreading. Mm-hmm. You know, the narratives of how Buddhism goes to Southeast Asia, of how it goes into Central Asia, how it goes into East Asia, how it goes, you know, and then new chapters of that being written even today as diaspora communities, right, of Asian Buddhist diaspora communities that move around the world and converts and all kinds of things like that.
Sorry.
So this spreading, right, is key.
Yeah.
Right. This spreading is key. So we should think through the labor of the figures who do that spreading.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so you've used the phrase greatest hits in passing, so I have to seize on that now and ask you about the other project that you were doing concurrently with writing mm-hmm. this thesis, and that it seems to be very much still on your mind, even as you're now moving to a book, which is Dancing in My Dreams, the Tina Turner book. Mm-hmm. What was it that prompted you to take on this insane undertaking of two books in one go in the same graduate student years? And did they complement one another, or did you have to kind of go to different sides of your brain and different sides of your calendar to make it possible to write both?
They complemented each other for me. So the one thing I want to say, you know, and this is a podcast for the host and for the sense I stand for.
Yeah.
I think my project, the two projects that I did, were possible because I was at Stanford. And that is because there is a... When I was in the program at Stanford, there's a focus on doing the best work that you can, whatever direction that takes you. And so in many ways, I feel that having been at the Hope Center at Stanford, you know, in Buddhist studies at Stanford and in the American religion subfield as well, but in the Buddhist studies subfield at Stanford, being encouraged to do actual humanistic work, to do research, right, and to see where that research goes. And so I could not have done the two projects, I think, if I weren't at Stanford. Being at Stanford then, right, it did not require two different parts of my brain. What it required was taking the research skills developed. So I read almost every year in Sanskrit almost every year, and then, you know, other languages along the way. And so for any grad students out there watching this, take language class every year, even when coursework is overwhelmed. Taking those same skills, for example, in other classes as well, but I'm talking specifically about language courses, that same skill, right, where you pick up a primary source and you learn to read it line by line, close reading, right? You learn to, as a methodology, line by line, inside and out, interrogate it, ask questions of the questions you've asked, you know, and pursuing that line by line by line, to take that same methodology and to close read a person, in this case Tina Turner's, life from the perspective of religion. Analyze every interview, right? Mm-hmm. Every writing of hers, everything. Where is religion here? What does she mean by religion? How is religion functioning for her? What role is it playing in her career? Right. She's also a business, right? Any figure like Tina Turner is also a commercial entity, right? So for her fans to go see her live, to buy her material, and she's talking about Buddhism and some of that material, right? Then that means Buddhism becomes a part of her commercial business. So how do we think through that? How do I understand that? It's the same skill,
yeah.
Right? Just apply it to now a different set of primary sources.
Yeah, wonderful. And then, you know, while you're doing that, there's the skill of poring over those texts and those materials and doing so in the classroom, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But you're also going on separate grant-funded trips, right? You're going to Pune, India. Yeah. You're going to Tennessee.
Yeah.
Is the other project still kind of percolating in the back while you're kind of ostensibly, I'm just here to study Sanskrit, or I'm just here to go into the census records of Tina's family? Yeah, what's the process there?
Yes. With the research trips, you know, I feel like one of the joys of being a scholar, you know, you're always thinking. Mm-hmm. And I was jotting down little ideas. So things would strike me when I was in the archive, you know, doing the research for Dancing in My Dreams. Things would strike me, and I would say to myself, I should look at, now that I'm thinking about Tina Turner this way, I should re-look at, you know, how I'm reading chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra. Mm-hmm. Right, and so, to give you an example of how these two projects overlap, chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra is called the Dharmapanika Parivarta, the Dharmapanika chapter, the Dharma Preacher chapter. That chapter kind of describes what the preacher is like. Right? But it has this very interesting moment that many scholars have written about, where it says that those who preach the Dharma, in the kind of final Dharma age, if you will, the final period of the world, that they actually are high-ranking bodhisattvas who have the karma, the propensities, have built the good merit, right, the good fortune, to actually be born in other world systems, better world systems. Right? Now, for those listening, you don't know, our world system is called the Saha world, the difficult world, the question mark world, right, the world where everything is hard, right? But there are these other world systems, right, according to Buddhist cosmology, right, or Mahayana Buddhist cosmology, there are these other world systems where things aren't so hard. Right, and things are much better. So the question becomes, why are these bodhisattvas in the Saha world? If they've propitiated millions and trillions of buddhas and carried out all of this practice, why aren't they in the good place? Right. The Lotus Sutra, this chapter, chapter 10, provides an answer to this question. It says, these beings who have come to preach the Dharma, they've actually forsaken, they've given up the good fortune that they've built, right? They've forsaken the reward due them, and they've come to this Saha world to do the work. And the text says, you should know that they are the envoy of the Buddha. They carry out the Buddha's work. And so I think that's a very interesting, right? So as I started to think about Tina Turner, and I started to think about the way she talks about her own life, right? What karma in past lives, so I talk about this in chapter 4, of Dancing in My Dreams, right? In chapter 4, I talk about what karma as a notion and what past lives as a notion does for Tina Turner and her understanding of interpersonal dynamics and social connections, right? Social, kind of the social sphere. Mm-hmm. And so I started to think that is actually very interesting that the way that Turner talks about her relationship with Ike Turner and what that relationship was and why it was so difficult and why she went through that from her perspective.
Right.
And thinking of this alongside chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra, where it says, these figures have built the merit to be born in better circumstances, but they have chosen to be born to carry out, in these harder circumstances, to carry out the Buddha's work. So that's just one example of how projects overlap.
That's
for me.
No, that's terrific. And so I'm going to pinpoint another one of those moments where the overlap is really explicit. Because in the acknowledgments to your dissertation, you have this really lovely final line where you dedicate the work to Tina, to Tina Turner, and you call her a Dharmabhanaka of the highest caliber. And I imagine you don't use that kind of phrase and that term lightly.
Right.
So what's the case? Like what should we see in her life that would merit that kind of title?
That Tina Turner spoke about and considered her life's mission, from her own words, right? She considered herself to be a Dharmabhanaka. You know, she didn't use the language, but she considered herself to be somebody who was using her life and career to spread Buddhism, right? Even when she wasn't talking about Buddhism, right? So there's a difference. There's a great scholar, Scott Mitchell, his book, The Making of American Buddhism, right? He talks in chapter 4, a little bit in 5 as well, about this like distinction that he draws from another scholar between speaking about and, I shouldn't have even brought it up, I can't remember, but it's the difference between speaking for and speaking about. Mm-hmm. Right? And so even when Turner wasn't explicitly talking about Buddhism, she saw herself as talking about Buddhism. Right? What if we take that seriously? And I think a lot of my work is driven by, again, back to what I was talking about, these reading classes, right? A lot of my work is driven by that training and that impulse to take seriously what's in front of me. You know, it's a very interesting thing. It's a bit of a tangent. Forgive me on this. It's very interesting to me that there are many scholars, there are many who don't do this, right? But there are many scholars who actually read the material in front of them almost by not reading that material, right? By reading what's on the page, seeing what's there, and they say, well, that can't be. You know, this doesn't make it.
That doesn't fit with the theory or the thesis that I've devised.
With how I see it. Right? Mm-hmm. But I was trained, right, to engage in close reading. I was engaged to, before you jump off the page, to start to read that page well. Every phrase. So I'll give you an example. Right. In with the phrase Avum, right? What is Avum, right? Does it refer to what's coming next, or does it refer to... So Avum means basically thus, as follows, or as followed. Right? Does it refer to what just came? Does it or does it refer to what's coming next? Right. Now, you say, well, okay, well, this isn't ever. Like, it's okay. It's just let it go. Right. But I was trained, no, you don't let it go. What is, if a sutra starts with Avam Mayashrutam, right? The following was heard by me. I heard the following.
Yeah.
What is Avam? What is Maya? What is Shrutam? You think you know.
Mm-hmm.
But investigate, mm-hmm. right? That's what's on the page.
Yeah.
And you do that word by word, phrase by phrase, sentence by sentence, line by line. Until you know what the page says. Then you can go off page. So a lot of my work, whether it was on Tina Turner and religion and popular culture, Buddhism and popular culture, on pre-modern Mahayana sutras, right? It's the same process for me, right? And being in the archive, right? Looking at kind of figures of American religion, say in an archive, or looking at Buddhist manuscripts or something. Right, the same question. Right? I'm asking the same question. How can I see more carefully what is here?
Yeah.
And then how can I understand what is here?
Yeah. Right. So I imagine that kind of close reading and then rereading must be part of the project of now turning this work on Dharmavanikas into a book, right?
Yes.
Of going back over your own writing, going back over the sources of that writing.
Yes.
So in that process, are you finding that there is a new story to be told, new arguments to be made, new cases to be refined? Where are you at in that process?
Deep in the mud of that process. I'm finding, I think the overall arguments I made, I feel that those hold up. I think I am in the process now of more carefully ironing out some of the sub-arguments, right? So I have certain arguments in chapter 2 about aesthetics, about preaching traditions, how to understand this notion of, and we were talking about this before doing this podcast, pratisamvid, you know, these kinds of, it's a technical term, right? What exactly... How to translate that exactly?
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the process of rethinking.
Yeah,
that
these four qualities that
the, yeah these four Dharma qualities
supposed to have
right,
and how to translate that or articulate that
right?
Yeah,
how to accurately understand, you know, again with that close like what's it actually trying to say?
Do you want to give a try at it now? Is there a way you would describe those four qualities now to a kind of lay listener?
Yeah, for the lay listeners, it's fundamentally talking about the skills when we talk about a preach, you know. So it's not only Dharmabhanikas that are thought to have these skills, right?
Yeah.
But in my project, when Dharmabhanikas are said to have these skills, they are essentially a set of skills, pedagogical skills, that enables a Dharmabhanika to, in brief, understand the Dharma and communicate that understanding effectively. Right? Now, that's the simple version. But to actually unpack these descriptions, to actually accurately translate them, and that's a kind of ongoing process.
Yeah, fair
enough.
It was
never really satisfied.
Well, okay, but I'm glad we've gotten to pedagogical skills, because I think the thing that I'd love to close with is just asking you a little bit, you know, from prospective mortician now to assistant professor, and as someone who's studying the work of, you know, exegetically and passionately and charismatically conveying knowledge, how this maybe has influenced your own teaching or how you reflect on your own time in front of a classroom.
Mm.
What there is useful, what's different in the circumstance of a university classroom that can't fit this model that you've been researching historically, where do they align or disalign?
Well, sometimes it feels like universities and colleges are designed to prevent the things that they want to see. But I think in many ways pedagogy is pedagogy, right? How do you speak and convey information in a way that your listener can understand, right? sometimes on multiple levels at the same time. And definitely in the college classroom, like a congregation. So studying the SGI community, right? Especially the research I was doing for this Tina book, right? Something I find very interesting, and this is true of many religious communities that I've had the opportunity to engage with, to encounter, to study. Everybody's there for a different reason, you know? Mm-hmm. Some people are there because they love the philosophy, right? Or there's this phenomenon of like Dharma talks, yeah. You know, at like Buddhist centers and things like that. Some people are there because they want to hear philosophy. Some people are there for community. Mm-hmm. They don't really care about them, you know? Some people just like, it has something to do, mm-hmm. right? Something that seems wholesome yeah. to do. Some people are there because their life needs to change. Definitely in the Soka Gakkai Buddhist community, like when I interview people who were there at some of their earliest meetings that Tina Turner attended, right? And I interview some of these people. So some of their stories are in chapters 3, 4, and 5 of the book. They describe how she came and she sat in the back. You know, it was very quiet and just took it in, you know, and turned that into Tina Turner. Right. So from where she was when she left her ex-husband Ike Turner and the kind of the disarray that her life was in and all this stuff to becoming Tina Turner. Right. That's what she was getting out of this. Somebody else was going through something different. Right. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's also true of the college classroom. There are students who are there, maybe a few these days, who love the material. Right. They signed up because they and they saw it was a class on an intro to Buddhism class, and they're taking it. Buddhism pop culture class, they're taking it. Some students, it fulfills the distribution requirement, and it's the last class they could get into. Some students, they heard that you don't have any papers due at the end of it. Some heard that you have papers due at the end of it, and they know that they write well, right? Some, none of the above, right? Some are straight A students, some are hovering somewhere around C and its cousins, right? But they're all there. So how do you work to all of them being there, right? How do you teach all of them, right? Now, it is not, I do not consider it as a teacher, right? I do not consider it my responsibility to reach everybody. I consider it my responsibility to reach anybody, right? So how do I teach in a way that that can happen? That something can happen. Yeah. I think that is much the same work of that any teacher, any preacher, anybody who's interested in their message being conveyed. And I think close with that, tying this, you know, back to even the Tina Turner project. As a Buddhist, Tina Turner once said, or is recorded as saying, that I play to whoever's there. If 100 people is there, if 100,000 people are there, it's the same show, and I am the same Tina, right? That, I think, is what a teacher is trying to do. And in many different settings, you know, as I researched for the book, in many different settings, Tina Turner tried to disseminate her understanding of Buddhism in ways that were germane to the person listening to her, but also germane, also accurate to how she understood it. And in the same way, I am trying to convey that when I'm teaching, you know, my intro to Buddhism class, and my this class, and my that class, I am trying to accurately convey to the best of my ability what I understand Mahayana Sutras, for example, to be saying, where I see that to fit in global histories of knowledge production and literary production, right? And if I'm lucky, to also say a little something about what I think that can do for a student. Yeah. You know, what I think that learning this kind of literature and the religio-literary traditions of South Asia and East Asia and so on, what I think that can do, right, in their own self-formation.
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect note to end on. What a story and parable, not only Tina's of being the student at the back to the perfect teacher filling the stadium, but then what that means for you as a mission. Lovely and so beautifully put.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ralph, for doing this, for coming back to Stanford, for talking to us, for being on the show, and for sharing that wisdom on all fronts.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
And I want to say thank you to the host center, right? Irene, Paul, John, James, Stephanie, everybody, you know, thank you. I thank you for preparing so well for this, and we'll do it again.
Yeah, we'll do it again. That's for sure.
Thanks again to Ralph Craig for coming on the show. If you want to learn more about Tina Turner's Buddhist conversion, I highly recommend reading Ralph's Dancing in My Dreams. We'll be waiting for his forthcoming book on the Dharmabhanikas, and we'll be keeping an eye out too for an upcoming documentary reader on Black Buddhism, co-edited with fellow Stanford and Ho Center alum Adina McNichol. We'll share more information about these titles when the details come out. As always, the music for this episode is a recording from Ani Choying Drolma's Buddhist Chants and Songs, performed at Stanford's Memorial Church in 2017. Until next time, this has been the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast.